From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The more ISIS concentrates the minds of world leaders, the clearer it becomes that this is no ordinary terrorist group. Even beyond their brutality and ambitions, we're talking today about their sprawling money-making machine. They're raking in hundreds of millions of dollars from oil and taxes and extortion and more, managing a budget, keeping clean books, and spending big on building their caliphate. This hour on Point, ISIS Incorporated, the business, the economy, the money behind ISIS. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How does the ISIS economy get reined in? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will dive into the money in just a moment, but first, we want to go to the news of Turkish jets having shot down a Russian fighter jet along the Syrian-Turkish border. This is ominous stuff. To find out more, we turn to Moscow to Washington Post correspondent Andrew Roth. Andrew, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us. How is Russia responding to this news?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I think it's become quite clear with President Vladimir Putin speaking a few hours ago that Russia had a very sharp response. Putin called it a stab in the back from the accomplices of terrorists, and it's pretty clear in this case that he's more or less calling Turkey a country that's also supporting terrorists. So it's been a very strong response.
Do we have any sense from independent intelligence of whether Russians have been carefully observing this border as they've been very active in the skies over Syria? Have there been repeated incursions into Turkish airspace?
Well, this is an argument between the Turks and the Russians about whether or not the plane was there. So Russia doesn't accept that the plane was in Turkish airspace. It says that it was over Syria still. Russia has been carrying out a lot of bombing raids in these mountainous area north of Latakia, where their air base is. And they say that they've been attacking, actually, with regard to today's show, sort of places where ISIS has either oil infrastructure or places where fighters go across the border. The Turks, on the other hand, say that the Russians have been bombing villages that are inhabited by the Syrian Turkmen, who are a Turkish people. And so the Syrians say that they have to sort of protect that group. And they had even asked the UN Security Council or had discussed holding a discussion about this issue in particular just a day or two ago.
What's the latest on the pilots? We saw two ejected. What's known now about their status?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. In Russia at the moment, the latest about the pilots is that based on social media and other reports around the world, it seems that at least one of the pilots is dead. Maybe both are dead. Russia, at the point in media and also from officials, haven't discussed at all what the fate of the pilots is. So there haven't been any official statements about whether any of the pilots have been killed, whether they've been hurt. At least officially, we don't know what's happened to them from this side.
Before and apart from this incident, and that's a small word for it maybe, what's the tenor of Russian-Turkish relations? Good, bad, middling?
Russian-Turkish relations are okay. There's already been an argument between Turkey and Russia over this kind of incident before, when a Russian plane, just after Russia began its intervention, flew into Turkish airspace, and there was already sort of discussions between the ambassadors about this. In general, Russia, on the one hand, has called Turkey sort of a brotherly nation quite often, and had even discussed running an oil project through Turkey recently as it tried to build closer relations. But when it comes to Syria, they're basically on completely polar opposite sides of this case. Turkey is very opposed to Assad, and Russia is one of his strongest backers. So even though rhetorically, the relationship has seemed okay at times, there's really more animosity beneath that.
I'm reading right now, Andrew, that the Russian Foreign Minister Sergey Lavrov has canceled his scheduled upcoming trip to Turkey. What about the prospect of getting Russia into an alliance to fight ISIS? John Kerry and others have been talking a lot about this in recent days. How does this incident affect the likelihood? How might it affect the likelihood of that happening?
Well, I think that the way that the Russians would describe it is, we would love to get you into a collaboration, to fight ISIS. The Russians basically want to be in a collaboration to fight ISIS with the West. They want to escape from isolation, particularly that concerning sanctions and Ukraine. But they want to have a central role in that, and they want it to be on their terms. this is probably not going to help that in any case, because in the short term there might be some discussions about how to avoid a similar incident again, but in the long term it's going to sow some animosity and kind of make it harder for the Russians and the Turks to work together. And because Russia expects NATO to say something about what Turkey has done, it will probably make it harder for Russia and NATO to work together as well.
Is Russia threatening any reprisal at this point, Andrew, beyond his tough language?
There hasn't been anything in particular, so I don't think that we're about to see, the beginning of actual violent confrontation between Russia and Turkey. I suspect that Russia is looking for a kind of asymmetric response, and this could be something that has to do with the economy. A lot of Russian tourists go to Turkey, and there are discussions about maybe an airline ban, or, suggesting Russians not go to Turkey. So there might be another way, or the Russians could also support some of Turkey's enemies in Syria as well. So there could be another sort of response that Russia can make without directly entering a conflict with Turkey.
Andrew Roth, Moscow correspondent for The Washington Post, has been with us for a few minutes here. Andrew, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's go to ISIS and the financial system that fuels it. Joining me now from Beirut in Lebanon is Erica Solomon, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. She and her colleagues have been doing ongoing reporting on ISIS's quite substantial finances. It's called Inside ISIS, Inc. You can find a link at our website, onpointradio.org. Erica Solomon, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So begin to lay out, if you would, the money behind ISIS. How big is it? What are the primary sources?
Well, it's big. And the big problem, as you alluded to in your introduction, is how much they involve local communities in the way that they make money. But the main things that they're doing, obviously, the biggest is oil. So they control most of the large producing oil fields in eastern Syria. And that's a huge bulk of their revenues. Our estimates were around 400 to 450 million. The U.S. estimates that it's about 500 million. And then you also have the secondary, but still a very critical thing, is zakat, which is a type of tax or tithe based on Islamic law. And they take this on so many things, agriculture, business. Everybody has to pay some form of this, and it actually can be very lucrative when you start looking at it broadly in all the different areas that they control. The third thing, which is a little harder to grasp, is extortion, money from kidnapping, money that they force people to pay in order not to be attacked. But that's kind of a very fluid thing, and it's becoming, I think, less significant as they basically create what they call their caliphate on the ground between Iraq and Syria.
When you tote it all up, what kind of revenue stream do they have annually? If it's 450 or 500 million, half a billion just from oil, add in all the rest. Are there credible estimates out there about what kind of cash flow they're riding on?
I would be very hesitant to give you a number because, of course, you have to also put into calculations, which we are trying to make, we're working on right now, about how much they spend, which is also quite substantial when you just think about fighters alone, whether it's, tens of thousands, that they have employees as well that they employ from the oil fields to civil services, telephone lines. They also use a lot of that fuel. So when we're talking about these estimates of how much they would make, you have to think about how much maybe they're actually using themselves. So even if the number reached about a billion a year, you still have to go back and look at how much they're actually spending on themselves and on their war machine. So I would be hesitant to give you a real number, though I guess some people would say it's reaching maybe close to a billion.
But already right there, we are in different territory. Maybe a billion in, a billion out, including salaries for fighters all over the place, including as far as Afghanistan. And who knows? Now in Europe, questions raised there. This is not like the old days of, let's say, Al-Qaeda and checks being cut by faceless sheikhs somewhere down in the Gulf.
That's true. The Al-Qaeda model is very much built, as far as we know, on money transfers from donors. That does play a role still with ISIS, by the way. Some people estimate up to $50 million a year still comes in that way. They don't lose an opportunity to make money, and that's a very important thing, I think, to stress, because you know, if you just look at the oil or you just look at the taxation or the extortion, you're missing the bigger phenomenon, which is that they, with the territory they grasp and their connections that they have built in these areas, they will find a way to make money. Before they took over Mosul in June 2014, they were already almost extracting as much money from that area on extortion. So as long as they have a physical presence, it's very difficult to cut off some means for them to fund themselves.
I mean, not to mention the whole idea of a war machine. In the past, terror groups, we thought of small outfits. Now we see these fleets of Tacoma pickup trucks. Often they look brand new, running all over the place. I don't know if those are just the ones that make the videos, but there's a lot of materiel that's being deployed here and a lot of money behind it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point as well, because another thing I like to point out is that people focus a lot on the dollar amount, how much they're making, which, as I mentioned to you, can be very difficult to calculate. But they find other ways of getting things, like those Toyotas that you're talking about, mm-hmm. or materials. Sometimes when they say pressure someone to cooperate, it won't be for money. It will be, we need you to get us X amount of cars, and then you're off the hook for whatever it is they accuse them of. Or there's all types of ways that they find, in a sense, a way to profit or take advantage. And it's not always through dollars. Another really important example, in my opinion, is in Syria. Almost all of the electrical grid is run through gas, and they basically are sharing control of gas operations with the Syrian regime right now. Neither side can cancel out the other because they both rely so much on power, on electricity, as a huge sign of their, what they say is their credibility. So
their credibility as an ongoing, they
as
say,
a, as
state.
A,
And what an idea, sharing the natural gas with the same people they're fighting against very often. People say, cut off the money. But that is hard here. We'll look at what that means, efforts to do that. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about ISIS, Inc., the business, the economy, the money behind ISIS, where it comes from, how much there is, and whether it can be shut down. You can join us this hour. Can you picture a whole economy, tattered but real, behind ISIS? Can you count the ways ISIS makes money? Oil, taxes, extortion, selling history, antiquities, selling grain. And what do you do when there's no feeder tube from outside to choke off, when it's mainly internally generated revenue? Erica Solomon's with us from Beirut in Lebanon, Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, where they've been doing a lot of reporting on this. You can link to it at our website, Inside ISIS, Inc., at onpointradio.org. With us as well right now from Berkeley, California, is Benjamin Bainey, international policy analyst at the RAND Corporation. He's been following all of this for a couple of years, co-author of Counterterrorism Finance During Wartime and the forthcoming Foundations of the Islamic State. Benjamin Bainey, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So is this not the traditional Al-Qaeda model? It's not easy just to crimp a hose and have the flow stop. But it also means that ISIS has to spend on the people in the territory that it has conquered, taken over. How's that going? How's the cash flow? I mean, they've got to run an economy of sorts.
They do, and I think there's been an extreme difference in terms of opinions out in the media reporting about how much exactly ISIS is actually investing in a real state that serves the population. But I think more broadly what's generally agreed upon is that ISIS spends probably the majority of its funding just supporting its own members. In our view, really most of the infrastructure that they've built up is organizational. So they've really built up an extensive hierarchical group that is really, you know, meant to regulate the economy and the broader society that it's in control of. I think beyond that, we don't see a whole lot of investment in things like roads or new infrastructure projects. We see, you know, a little bit of spending here and there on hospitals and things that people immediately need.
Over time, this is a big deal. I mean, if you're just trying to go in and break them from the outside, their resources are a problem. If you are in the kind of harass and attack and wait them out strategy, which maybe is more like the Obama strategy so far, if they can't create a decent life for the people who they're ruling, they may have resistance inside. I want to listen back to a little bit of the sound of what's going on. First, back to last summer, and I'm talking all the way 2014. This was Paul Wood from the BBC reporting on the takeover of Mosul, the big northwestern Iraqi city, by ISIS. Among the other things they took over there, maybe $1 billion out of bank vaults there.
The jihadis are now effectively in control of Iraq's second city with 2 million people. ISIS fighters seized the government headquarters and the airport. They emptied the jails. 1,000 prisoners escaped from one, it said.
Emptied vaults as well, we're told, and reports all the way up to $1 billion there that they may have seized. The U.S. going after oil transport and revenues in recent days. This is just last week. This is U.S. Army spokesman Colonel Stephen Warren in Baghdad briefing Pentagon reporters on a video link. And he said last week U.S. aircraft shot 116 or destroyed 116 tanker trucks carrying oil for ISIS. Before they did, they gave the local drivers advance warning.
This is our first strike against tanker trucks, and to minimize risk to civilians, we conducted a leaflet drop prior to the strike, and we did a show of force by we had aircraft essentially buzz the trucks at low altitude. So you can see it's a fairly simple leaflet. It says, get out of your trucks now and run away from them.
That's last week, 116 trucks. This week, yesterday, the U.S. military is saying it had destroyed 283 tanker trucks used by the Islamic State to transport oil out of eastern Syria. And it's not just the U.S. Russia's targets are sometimes ambiguous, but they have been going after oil assets in this region. Here's some CBS News footage on that.
Russian ships in the Caspian Sea fired cruise missiles at the terror group's positions, targeting their oil reserves. So far this week, Russia says it has destroyed 15 oil facilities in Syria and 525 trucks carrying oil. Officials estimate the damage to the oil reserves have cost the terror group more than $1 million.
Erica Solomon, they're in Beirut in Lebanon. Can the oil revenue be shut down by shutting down its exit lines from Syria?
It will probably make a big difference. The question is whether they learn to adapt to it. About a year ago, the U.S. was targeting refineries because ISIS also used to control the refining portion of the oil trade. And ISIS adapted in a relatively quick period of time. I've spoken to traders in the area who we spoke to for our original report about oil, and you know, they seem to hold out this belief that there will be some modification and that trade will go on. Already we've heard stories of ISIS officials in control of fields coming up with new systems for traders to come and pick up oil so that they don't crowd around the fields. In our first report at that time, which was a few months ago, sometimes trucks would be waiting up to a month to get oil. That's how crowded they were with tanker trucks, if you can envision that, like 6 kilometer long lines of trucks. So this is a big change for them. I think the other thing with oil, though, you have to remember who is buying it. There's a possibility that some of it's going to the Syrian regime as well as to Turkey. But I mean, a huge portion of it is right there in front of you. It's being bought by people in opposition-held areas of northwestern Syria. They are completely dependent on oil coming from ISIS areas. So there is a question about, is there some way to provide them oil to deprive ISIS of one of these large customer bases?
Provide them oil from the outside so they're not buying from ISIS inside. Alexi's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Alexi, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering who was buying that oil and what was being done with it. Is there any chance that oil is coming back into the United States or into products that are being made that are being sold across the world?
We'll pick it up. Benjamin Bainey, Erica Solomon is telling us that a bunch of it may be consumed right there locally and bought right there. But we've also seen plenty of maps of smuggling routes out of Syria into Turkey. How far does this oil travel? Do we know?
I think the best estimate you can make is that it doesn't go very far. I think most of the products that we're seeing coming out of Iraq are of lower quality. Erica has talked about this in her reporting. So I think it's highly unlikely that much of it goes much further beyond maybe Turkey or Syria or Iraq more immediately. So I think the fundamental point is right, that most of the oil is probably being consumed in ISIS territory itself or right there in the neighborhood.
What about taxation/extortion? That's pulling money out of the local economy. What's the health of that economy with all the chaos that seems to be underfoot there? And how strong is that source of revenue longer term for ISIS, Benjamin?
Well, I think the economy is probably in shambles. I mean, this is a war zone. The war has been going on for a number of years now. I think a large or a significant proportion of the citizens in the area have fled. We've heard a lot about refugees. I think to a large extent those refugees are from ISIS territory itself. So I would say the economy is probably in very bad shape. Now, that said, I think ISIS has proven over a 10-year history that they've been able to extract revenue from the areas in which they control pretty effectively. Erica mentioned they charge taxes on all kinds of things. I think that's exactly right. And when you think about the group, as she said, in terms of the spending that they need to generate, their revenue needs are actually not really that high, right? I mean, in fact, it seems that they can probably cover their salaries, which is the majority of what they spend money on, just with oil revenue alone, maybe even twice over. So I think they're going to be able to continue this forward even with a significant economic decline beyond what we're even seeing now.
That makes them sound pretty rich in terms of what they need to work. Randall in Wellsburg, Iowa. Randall, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, I was wondering, was the U.S. ever involved at any point in time in funding ISIS?
That's a complicated question. Benjamin, what do you say to that?
I would say absolutely not. We've been, as I mentioned just a moment ago, we fought ISIS directly in Iraq, really from 2004, 2005 until we withdrew in 2010 and 2011. We spent many, many years directly within the U.S. military command in Iraq trying to figure out where ISIS was getting its money from. At the time, they were called the Islamic State of Iraq.
Right.
But no, I mean, the U.S. has been trying to fight this group very intensively for a long time.
What about inadvertent funding? I mean, a lot of money just went missing in Iraq during those years. A lot more was pumped into the Arab Awakening and who were fighting against these guys. But did they end up going over? The lines sometimes got murky.
The lines did get murky, and there was definitely a lot of cash slushing around the Iraqi economy, particularly when we were there. Shipping, pallets of U.S.
greenbacks.
Currency into the country. I think definitely some of that money, slushed around through the economy, and ISIS was probably able to tax it and take it from individuals. Now, does that mean the U.S. was funding ISIS? I'd say that's a huge stretch of the imagination. But that being said, yeah, there was a lot of U.S. money slushing around in Iraq, and I think ISIS has proven very effective at being able to find out, figure out where to take taxes from and how to extort it out of people.
Erica, Benjamin. Erica Solomon, what about other sources here? I mean, I'm reading about big grain sales that ISIS could generate as much as $200 million a year. They hold some of the most fertile parts of Iraq and Syria. About phosphate and cement and sulfur and sort of big industrial stuff. And then the funky end of this, I mean, human trafficking. And we've been reading lately about amphetamine production in Syria, maybe fighters on it, but also selling it in and beyond that zone. What about the other strands of potential revenue or real revenue here, Erica?
I think agriculture is definitely an important thing to look at. And yes, I've seen also estimates of about $200 million. what ISIS does, though, it depends on the area. So in some parts of Syria, for example, they the zakat that they charge to farmers will be extracted in a dollar amount or in the local currency, the Syrian lira. Whereas in Iraq, we mostly heard farmers talking about them taking an actual physical portion of their crop and selling it on the black market. I think it just depends for them. Again, they're adapting to the circumstances around them and what's the best way to profit off of this. As for other things, as we discussed, there will always find a way. I haven't found much about amphetamine or what's locally known as Captagon. I've definitely heard of cases of it being used, but as far as them controlling any means of production, there's a lot of things that people talk about because of how murky the situation is. And it could, in fact, be happening, but I haven't found any strong evidence of that.
I mean,
that.
We were reading in The Guardian recently, big production sold all over the Middle East and lots of fighters in that region fighting on speed, effectively. It's very, very potent speed.
Yes, and there is a lot of production in Syria, but as far as I'm aware, it's mostly controlled. It's in areas under regime and rebel control. But like I said, it's possible because they are always going to be looking for new ways of creating revenues.
Benjamin Bainey, does ISIS act more like a gang or like a state here? Of course, they present themselves as a state in the way they handle money. Do they budget? Do they have good command and control over this money? Is there good accounting for it? Or is it more loosey-goosey than that?
They're pretty strict with their accounting. So this is one of the things we've followed for the last decade or so is ISIS, wherever they've operated, they've left behind a significant paper trail because they're very bureaucratic. They're very hierarchical. They keep Excel spreadsheets of their finances in every area in which they operate. And then they pass those spreadsheets up inside the organization to their higher level overseers. So the organization is very disciplined. It knows exactly who's spending money on what and when. So they've been proven, you know, quite able to move money around to where it's needed. So if a local commander is short, he reports up the chain and they send money down to him. So what we've seen is they're very disciplined. They're able to share money across large distances, mostly through a system of couriers, you know, drivers that drive notes around and hand money off to the recipients. So over time, they've been pretty disciplined. But that said, they tend to spend whatever they have. At least this is true going back to the 2005 to 2010 period. We saw wherever they had money, they were either spending it or they were sending it up to their higher level commanders to kind of spread the wealth around. So there's not a lot of money kind of, you know, slushing around the system at the lower level. But we do think that there are kind of central repositories, what they call the general treasury, where they are keeping a kind of strategic reserve. Erica talked earlier about $1 billion potentially being taken out of bank vaults in Mosul. We know that before they even took Mosul, they had roughly $875 million in a kind of strategic reserve. So I think it's possible that there may be on the order of, you know, $1 billion potentially sitting around in the ISIS general treasury somewhere that if they do run short, they can then use to kind of spread the wealth around and make sure that things are able to keep running.
This is a different kind of cat when it comes to terror. We're going to look at how that might be targeted and the opportunity, but also challenges there. I mean, you've been, Erica, out where they're spending, they and others are spending no small amount of this money on arms. I mean, among other places, you were in the, I think, arms bazaar in Beirut lately. What did you see there, Erica?
Yeah, I was actually just there yesterday. You'd be surprised how open it is. That actually is a different thing. It's not directly related to ISIS, but it is weapons coming from Syria. And the point it illustrates is how it's a huge market right now in Syria because you have a lot of people feeding into it. You have Russia and Iran supporting the Syrian regime. They are giving them what they need to fight the opposition, the Syrian rebels, as well as ISIS. And you have the rebels who have their foreign backers also supplying them, maybe not as regularly, but definitely with a lot of bullets, you know, ammunition, heavy weaponry, missiles. And a lot of that ends up in the black market. There is a very active arms market on the black market in Syria. And it's showing up everywhere in Lebanon, in Iraq. And it basically means that ISIS can get what it needs in terms of weaponry. Usually what they need, as a lot of people have focused on, when they, just like any group right now in the war in Syria, when they take over territory, the first thing they go for is weaponry and ammunition, artillery that they can take. But the one thing you always need to keep buying is bullets. And so we found a lot of traders who work explicitly with ISIS just to go and get them, keep their bullet supply going. And they are buying them from the rebels. They are buying them from the regime. They are buying them from the Hashd al-Shaabi, the Iraqi Popular Defense Forces, the Shia militias. Anybody who has bullets, ammunition to put on the black market, it's a good chance ISIS is getting their hands on it.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about ISIS, Inc., the business, the economy, the money behind ISIS, where it comes from, how much there is, and whether it can be shut down, how that might work. Benjamin Bainey is with us with the Rand Corporation out of Berkeley, California today, author of the forthcoming Foundations of the Islamic State, Management, Money, and Terror in Iraq. Erica Solomon is with us with the Financial Times, Middle East correspondent with them, with us from Beirut today. They've got a big series running called Inside ISIS, Inc., and it's really eye-popping, all the different streams of money coming into ISIS now. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Jacob Shapiro joins us in just a moment. Here's sound of an ISIS video posted on Friday. It's a French-speaking fighter claiming to be in Raqqa, says that the recent French airstrikes did not make a dent, he says, in ISIS defenses, only killed civilians. Well, who knows, but that's the claim here. But reminding Europe that ISIS can reach out, it's proven now, and attack.
Inshallah, par la permission du Tout-Puissant, nous vengerons nos frères et nos sœurs qui sont persécutés. Et sachez que la fin est proche. Nous vous avons déjà prouvé, ô vous l'Europe,
he's saying, you know, we've already proven, Europe, that we are capable of acting on your soil, and with plenty of money behind them to do that, you can join us. What's this whole money picture tell you about the right way forward on ISIS? Jacob Shapiro joins us right now from Princeton, New Jersey. He's a professor at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, author of The Terrorist's Dilemma, Managing Violent Covert Organizations. Jacob Shapiro, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
There is kind of a debate, not kind of, there's a real debate out there right now about whether to go in and try and roll over the caliphate or, you know, hit it, but sit back and let it fall of its own weight. With this much money, can the world afford to sit back? Does it mean you have to go in?
Well, Tom, I think it depends how you think about ISIS. And so if you think about it as a state and put it in comparative perspective, it actually looks quite weak. Right, so you take the revenue estimates that are out there on an economy that Ben highlighted is sputtering and falling apart over time, and in the best year of its existence, it put the revenue somewhere between those of Belize at the low end and Suriname at the high end. So if what you're saying is you want to fight a three-front war against states whose defense budgets are each 8 to 30 times your total revenues,
three-front
that
war,
doesn't look
you
good
lost,
for the long run.
Three-front war? What do you mean by that?
So ISIS is fighting in the north against the Kurds, in the east against Iraq, and in the west against various other militias and the Syrian government. So they're fighting a three-front war on revenues that are tiny compared to other states. So that doesn't look good for the long run.
Is there any sign that that activity is sputtering? I mean, so far it's been, until recently, primarily expansion.
So I was looking at this yesterday, and they've been losing territory steadily in the north and against Iraq and in northern Syria. They've taken some territory in the south in Syria recently. But the period of rapid expansion is certainly over, and the net amount of population that they control has been dropping steadily over the last couple of months.
So is that a wait them out? Does that suggest a wait them out strategy here? They'll fall of their own weight, Jacob?
I think it does, because they're certainly going to, unless they figured out some way to circumvent the relationship between resources and success in war that's governed every other war for the last couple centuries. But also, if you think about the options to go in, it's certainly true that you could remove ISIS's control of Raqqa, right? NATO and the U.S. certainly have the capacity to do that. But then what comes next, right? And what has been learned over the course of the last 15 years in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere, and certainly if you think about Libya, is what comes next can be very messy, expensive, and hard to predict. And so it's not obvious that you end up in a better situation with respect to attacks like the one in Paris by going in now than you do by containing, increasing law enforcement attention to the issue, and waiting for them to collapse of their own internal failings.
Benjamin Bainey, you've called ISIS something like al-Qaeda on steroids and built for territory holding. Does that mean that, in your view, a kind of a wait-them-out, starve-them-out strategy will work? Are we on that path now, or does it have to be more invasive?
Yeah, I don't think waiting is going to work in this case. You know, we've seen with ISIS that they've invested in a really robust security state. So they don't just have religious police out monitoring whether people are going to prayers or making sure people aren't smoking, but they also have a very serious security apparatus. And we've seen this going all the way back to the early days of ISIS in 2005, 2006. And really what this security apparatus does is it roots out local opposition. When they move into a new area, the security apparatus figures out who are the political opponents of the group, and they weed them out. They go through, they arrest them, and in a lot of cases they execute them. So I think just sitting back and waiting is probably isn't going to work. And I think more broadly what we have to ask ourselves is ISIS a group that we can live with? Can we live with them owning territory? And I would argue that we cannot. They have apocalyptical goals. These goals call for attacks in the West to bring upon the apocalypse. They also have conducted, you know, extensive atrocities against minority groups. So we can't live with this group. I think the strategy has to be a strategy of defeat, and most of the presidential candidates and President Obama himself agrees with this. The question is how to do it, and I think the way to do it is getting the politics right. And you know, we tried a military-first strategy in the early part of the Iraq War, 2005 to 2010, going in with heavy U.S. Mm-hmm. ground forces and trying to do this ourselves. And I think what we found is doing that, while it created a security situation that was good and that was conducive, us doing it actually ruined the ability to get the politics right. So I think the way to do it is have locals go first, have the U.S. and the coalition support them through air operations and training and funding and armaments, but the locals have to do it first. So I think the strategy should be defeat, but it should be one that's done through partners.
I want to look at what going after the finance infrastructure might mean, and I'll bring that to you, Erica. But one moment, let me get a call from Montreal, Canada here. Bankin is calling. Bankin, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom, and hi to everybody.
Hello.
Well, I'm Kurdish from Syria, and I'm in. I'm living in Montreal right now, Canada.
Yeah.
And I have just a couple of questions. The first one is, I mean, why the Turkey is not helping Kurds, which is... they are modern fighters, and to close completely the Turkish border, the 100 kilometer left. So the money and the fighter and the gas tank and the petrol tank will stopping cross from there. And second thing, I mean, why the United States and allies, they were waiting 1 year to bomb those tanks after Russian did that? I mean, what they were waiting for? And also, everybody is suspicious about Turkey's role in the area. I mean, we are seeing they are founding Islamic people, you know. Not Islamic people, but, I mean, extremists. They are not doing anything for Syria or for the Kurds. They're just making more trouble and more problems.
Bankin, let me pick it up right there. And I appreciate your questions. I mean, we know the long-standing tension between Turks and Kurds, some of them Turkish Kurds. But, Erica, what about the question on the border between Turkey and Syria? Why hasn't Turkey closed that? Would that have a significant impact on trade and cash flows?
That is a very tricky question that Bankin raises. And yes, I think that a lot of people studying this issue and tracing it have reasons to point concern. But I think another thing to remember is not just the fact that the border is porous, but also that there are so many ways that this comes through. Just to give you an example, how does Mosul or Raqqa get most of its soap or food? Well, Turkey, not because Turkey opens its gates on the, you know, on the territory okay. between it and ISIS, but because people who are in rebel territories, also bordering Turkey, that are supported by Turkey, they go in and out of Turkey and buy supplies, and then they move further along that highway. The doors are open to them by ISIS, and they go on and sell those things to ISIS-controlled areas. So if you can get those kinds of things in, what stops you from getting in explosive materials? What stops you from moving things back out? So there is a lot of reasons to question the situation on the border, but there's also just a lot of reasons that it's almost impossible to completely shut down that border if you believe that you shouldn't deprive civilians of everything because they were unfortunate enough to live in an area controlled by ISIS.
So that gets to this issue of civilians woven in here. They may not be happy to be there, but they are there and they need soap and food too. What about, though, the question of the oil tanker trucks? I mean, that seems very recent that we've seen U.S. Warplanes taking out large numbers of them, but they've been bombing for a long time. Why did they wait to try and shut that down?
Absolutely. That has been a big question. When I was on the Iraqi-Syrian border this summer, I was with the Kurdish Peshmerga, and they were pointing out literally lines of oil tanker trucks going by asking me that very question. Why doesn't the coalition bomb them? They keep telling us we're not allowed to. And what the Americans have said is they were really concerned this time around of of holding on to any potential links with the civilian population. As you mentioned earlier in this broadcast, they've started to change that strategy.
I mean, they were worried that they would kill civilian truck drivers and they didn't want to alienate that population?
We got to remember that in these territories, there are very few ways to make money, and people are living under very difficult circumstances. A lot of people in eastern Syria are making money either directly or indirectly from cooperation with ISIS. They would argue that they don't have a choice. So, you know, this is where it gets very thorny. To really hit at ISIS resources like oil, you have to hurt the population. So it's a very difficult question, because that population also is critical to the ability to fight them internally. So this is a balancing act that I think they've been working out. I think now they've decided it's just too much. We have to go after those tankers. They've put out warnings.
Yeah.
And now
come down, run for your life, and then boom.
Yeah.
Benjamin Bainey, is there any precedent for this? I mean, in the big wars in the past, the Allies going after Nazi Germany, regular Germans suffered. I mean, that's just the way it was. Same in Japan. But here you've got something like perhaps a hostage population, general population with ISIS sitting on them. How does that change the challenge of intervening in here?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this goes without precedent. The current operation against ISIS's tankers, the coalition has actually named it Tidal Wave 2. It was named after Tidal Wave 1, which was an operation against Nazi infrastructure back in World War II. So you draw an apt comparison.
Except there, when civilians died in Dresden, it was considered, just the price of war. Here, the people dying on the ground are the ones that Washington hopes will rise up and fight ISIS.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that explains why the coalition has been so reluctant to go after targets that will impact the fundamental well-being of the population. Erica made that point very well. And I think we see that both in the question of oil and the importance of oil in the economy, which is why we hadn't taken actions against the truckers until this point. We started early on doing things against ISIS-owned refineries, hoping that would have an impact, and it didn't have the impact we'd wanted. So now we're broadening that operation. We also see that against banks. We know that ISIS took banks in Mosul. Some of those banks are, one of them is the Central Bank of Iraq branch, so it's an Iraqi asset. There were other private banks. We haven't gone after those targets, as far as I know, mostly because the money inside of them belongs to either the state of Iraq or to private individuals. And similarly, one of ISIS's key revenue sources in Iraq, at least, is taxing salaries from the Iraqi government. So up until summer, the Iraqi government was sending the salaries for the state employees into ISIS territory, even though it was not controlled by the Iraqi government anymore.
Wow. Okay.
And supposedly in June, the Iraqi central government started to cut down on those salaries. I think it still remains to be seen whether they have been completely cut off or not. But even the Iraqis have been reluctant to cut off those payments because it's part of the lifeblood of the local economy. So I think the point is a good one. These are people that by and large don't want ISIS around. And so we should be, I think, hesitant to go after things that are supporting the population and keeping them from abject poverty and potentially even starvation. So I don't think this goes without precedent. But I do think that the coalition has rightly been reluctant to hurt the population.
What about money moving out of this area? Jacob Shapiro financing whatever happened in Europe. Do we know how that works? And now things are being threatened all over the place. There have been reports since the Paris attacks of ISIS being very active in using Bitcoin. Some people said it's one of the biggest holders of Bitcoin in the world. I have no idea, but that notion is out there. How are they moving money out of their zone?
So historically, it's never been hard for terrorists to move money because the volumes that they need to move to conduct operations pale in comparison to what needs to flow for the rest of the economy, whether licit or illicit. Right? So if you think about all the different kinds of economic movements that we've been hearing about today, all of that requires moving funds in and out of the areas that ISIS controls. And so if you want to pick out of that the small amounts of money required to fund overseas operations, that's an incredibly difficult task. And so you ask, how do you move money? The same ways you do for all these other purposes.
So really, it doesn't sound like there's a separate you know, choke off their financing strategy here that's distinct, Erica Solomon, from the rest of whatever approach the world takes to confronting ISIS. It's all embedded, it sounds like, Erica.
Yes, there is a lot of that. I mean, there are things that are targeted. The informal money transfer system, which is called Hawala locally, is widely used right now between Syria and Turkey, for example, or between ISIS-held parts of Iraq and government-held parts of Iraq. You know, a lot of that, most of it, as Jacob points out, is just normal trade. Traders who are coming in to bring that soap and food, and then they don't want to carry their money through a war zone, so they use these transfer systems, which are the only ones available. So, hey, yeah, you could send money that way as well to do anything.
A billion a year maybe being raised, a billion a year maybe being spent. This is big money. This is new terrain in terms of fighting terrorism, if that's exactly what this is. I want to thank all three of you for being with us. Jacob Shapiro at the Woodrow Wilson School, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome, Tom.
And Mr. Bainey, thank you very much for all your work on this. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Erica Solomon with the Financial Times, you guys have done yeoman's labor on this. A link to their report, ISIS Inc., at our website, On Point Radio. Erica, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica, with help from Fatima Tanis and Dave Tarantino. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.